This is the Keep Chopping Wood podcast hosted on Big Cat Country and SB Nation. Please rate and review us on iTunes. A lot of you have done it. It really helps the show and its outreach. If you want to tweet about the show, go ahead and tweet at the Big Cat Country handle. Use the hashtag Keep Chopping Wood. And any sponsors that want to send us money to sell product, we will absolutely do that for you guys at any time. Just go ahead and contact us. So for this show, we're going to be previewing the Packers. We've got a guest on this time, Justice Mosqueda. You can follow him on Twitter at Jumosk. Hank, Ryan, and Zach are all back with me this time. So basically, we're just going to broach topics about the opener, previewing different things. But what I first wanted to talk about and to kind of set Justice up, he covers the Packers for Bleacher Report. But one of the main things that he really does and he really works on is a metric that he has, and it's called Force Players. And what it does is it measures combine data and athletic testing for edge players, defensive ends, and pass rushing outside linebackers. And it's a very predictive and great metric. One of the best that I've ever seen in actually being predictive and being able to predict the success or failures of guys. And I've actually been trying to think a lot this week of how I can kind of set you up to talk about force players without going on a huge tangent. But I mean, basically, the basis of it, if I'm getting it right, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're looking basically at body types, and if those body types pass certain thresholds for agility and explosiveness, because it seems like those two things, and especially with the three-cone time, the 40, and the vertical and broad jump, are very predictive in generating or predicting how well pass rushers do. Is that correct, Justice?
Yeah,
I'll let you just kind of expound on it.
Yeah, so basically, like, the biggest issue that we have with combine metrics right now is that people know what a good 40 time is. Like, if I tell you a guy runs a 4.440, it doesn't matter if he's, like, a receiver or if he's an edge rusher, you know that he's fast. The issue is, like, if I ask some random football fan, right, what a good three-cone time is, he can't tell me if, a 7.4-second three-cone time is good or not. And those numbers are more reflective to success at edge positions where you're basically half manning a guy, right? Coming around the edge, trying to make as few steps as possible and as quickly as possible to get around a bookend to get to the quarterback. And the other issue that we have is we don't really adjust for density, which is kind of weird at the edge position where you could see a guy like Mario Williams who's like, 6'6". 290, or a guy like Elvis Dumervil, who's, 5'11", 250. So there needs to be a sliding scale of density, and people need to know what these numbers are. And this is kind of like, I guess it's just kind of like the decoder ring, right? And I've been working on it since, I want to say 2000, probably 2011, 2012 now. And basically I've refined it. And this stuff's the truth. I don't really know if you could go any other way with it. I mean, other than a couple of guys and the major ones like Alden Smith and Justin Tuck have major injuries coming out of college, basically non-force players just don't pan out, which is incredibly problematic when half of the NFL's first round picks at edge rusher are non-force players and about two-thirds for day two picks are also non-force players. It's not really a you should draft this guy because of this type of metric. It's more like, hey, avoid those other guys. I mean, the best way I've tried to explain it is that it's basically a risk management tool.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. It's not that so much like if a guy passes the filters for having the thresholds and necessary agility and explosion and having the right body type, it's not automatically saying draft this guy because he might not be any good. It's more so saying that the guys who don't pass those filters, to completely avoid them, because, and this is something that you and I have talked about, is that with, and this will lead me to my next topic as well, is that you almost always have to pay sticker price for an edge rusher in the NFL draft. Like it's almost like quarterback, like the value of them is so high, and that you're never really going to ever get a discount on those guys. And so many, and basically like you said, it's not necessarily that every force player pans out. It's just that the chances are much greater. It's more so that non-force players at an astounding rate fail. And I don't know if you have those numbers with you. Like, you might have them off the top of your head. I don't know if you have them in front of you of how many of guys that don't pass these thresholds end up not even getting a second contract from the teams that draft them.
I have some numbers that I could pull up, but I do know that off the top of my head, I believe it's 7% of non-force players drafted in the fourth through third rounds who are in their 6 years since 2005 haven't been re-signed by their original team. So it's like basically like second year into your second contract, you're still with that franchise. Only 7% of them are able to come through that. Whereas like force players, I want to say it's something like 50 something. I mean, every stat, any way that you spin, either sacks or, you know, either sacks or compensation, or even if you want to go into like Pro Football References, they have a thing called career AV, which is basically, it tries to create like a linear scale for success of players, you know, historically. Everything is just tremendously skewed toward force players. So like basically, like the fourth best force player drafted since 2005 is like Justin Houston, right? And like the fourth best force player drafted non-force player drafted since 2005 is like Whitney Mercilus. And the gap between those two guys is just huge.
Yeah, it's the non-force players just really, they have very, very little upside, it seems. And it a lot of them, this is kind of projecting a bit, but it just kind of seems like they come into the NFL maxed out, whereas like the actual force players, a lot of them they get that derogatory name, like they're just workout warriors. Like a perfect example last year was Danielle Hunter, who the Bengals drafted. I think they got him in like the fourth round or coming out of LSU, and his workout numbers were just absolutely incredible. But I can't think of anybody on draft Twitter or anything who liked his tape. I mean, and obviously
I didn't even really like him. I was like, wow, he's crazy athletic and he has a punch, and you can see him transitioning speed to power. But he ran in that Bo Pelini defense where he's having to make tackle reads instead of ball reads.
Right.
So his best trait was explosion off of the line of scrimmage. And he was basically neutered by that defense. So it's like he never really even had the chance to show anything. He declared as a redshirt sophomore. He came into the league as a 20-year-old. So like that, I mean, there's just so many things going against him.
Yeah, exactly. So bringing this back as it relates specifically to the Jaguars, I was talking earlier about how you almost never get defensive ends, like you almost always have to pay sticker price for them. A guy that the Jaguars got in this draft, Tyrone Holmes, is a guy, I think he was one of the most athletic pass rushers in this entire class, and they ended up getting him in the sixth round. Usually when guys fall, it's edge rushing prospects, it's either because of injury or a lack of production, and the Jaguars got a guy who fell to the sixth round. And it was pretty much only because of the school that he went to and the competition that he played against. He went to Montana. But like I said, passed all of the thresholds and everything. And the Jaguars went – he wasn't like mind-blowing amazing in the preseason or anything. It was not like he was going against great competition in the preseason. But they put him out there and he wasn't lost and he was productive. And he showed some natural pass rushing traits. And they went ahead and they released him. They were trying to sneak him onto the practice squad, even though, like, in today's NFL culture, it's like fans know who this guy is. So it's like fans of other teams that are like pretty in tune know who this guy is and want him like to be signed to their team. Then you can bet your ass that like all 32 teams know you're not sneaking guys onto the practice squad basically anymore these days. So the Browns went ahead and claimed him. So far in the preseason, Dante Fowler and Yannick have kind of rotated at Leo. Neither one of them – Yannick's got a couple sacks, but neither one of them has been super impressive. So, I mean, I don't have really a specific question, but just kind of talk about, like, Holmes – the Holmes's athletic the thresholds that he passes and what makes him a force player versus Dante, who I know you've been very, very critical of. And I know it's kind of interesting too, because I remember on Combine Day, Dante has like the exact body type in terms of density that you would want. And he ran that fast 40, he ran 4.6, but he just kind of bottomed out in all of his other athletic testing. So, I mean, I just kind of wanted you to go into like those three players and how compare and contrast like how they did in the force players metric and the value you think of those three going forward.
Yeah, so for guys like Dante Fowler, really for edge rushers, you really have to have either incredible – you really have to have either incredible jumps or incredible agility drills. And agility drills would be the three cone and the short shuttle. And Tyrone Holmes did that. And basically, it's really odd. Even like the force players drafted in the fourth round, all these numbers are from 2005 on, right? Basically, at your peak, in your peak 3 years, if you're a fourth round pick, you should be making about 3.5 sacks a year. So over, what would that be? Over 3 years, you should be making like 10.5 sacks. That's your peak if you're a fourth round edge defender. Really, edge defenders outside of quarterback, there's not a position where you can so definitively, oh, okay, all the top players at this position were drafted super early, and there's just a tremendous bust rate and all that, right? So to find fourth round picks is kind of rare. And the Minnesota Vikings, you could probably make the case that in the past decade, the Minnesota Vikings probably have made the two best, I guess you'd say, chartable fourth round force players, only because Elvis Dumervil didn't have a full combine. So I can't really count him or call him either way. But, I mean, Everson Griffin and Brian Robeson are basically the two best fourth-round pass rushers in the league. And if you look at what Minnesota's doing defensively, it's pretty clear that they're just going to kind of draft athletic pass rushers and they're going to live with it, which is one reason why it was kind of interesting to me that a guy like Danelle Hunter kind of broke out there last year as, you know, a rookie rotating off of the bench. They also drafted Steven Witherly from Vanderbilt, who is if you want to get into it, he's a mid-tier guy, which is kind of different than a force player or a non-force player. It's kind of like this vague area, but he's very athletic. I think what kept him out was his short shuttle time, which relates more toward ankle flexion than it does hip flexibility.
Right.
Like Tyrone Holmes, when he was at his pro day, Minnesota's defensive line coach, like, talked to NFL.com about him and was like, he's crazy athletic. And, like, every single, like, thing in my, like, head just went off and was like, you know, the Vikings have more force players than anyone in the league. This seems to be a team where, like, they turn mid-round selections into quality pass rushers, which no one else in the league, you know, can really do. And I was just like, oh, crap, this dude probably ran something crazy. And then once NFL Draft Scout, I get the pro day numbers from NFL Draft Scout. I get the NFL Combine numbers from the NFL Combine sheet that I get sent to me legally. Shouts to NFL for keeping all that stuff behind the wraps. When I finally got those numbers, I was like, damn, this Tyrone Holmes guy, like, he's probably something. Like, you just look at his numbers, and it's just like, he's got to be something. I ended up turning on him against North Dakota State to open up the year, I believe, because that was already cut on Draft Breakdown.
Right, for Carson Wentz.
Yeah, so I ended up watching him. He didn't really get many reps against that Haig, the offensive tackle who got drafted, but he was going up against the right tackle that they had for Bison Nation, and he was beating him around the edge. I mean, he was beating him with power moves. He was beating him with speed. He had a counter move. And really, honestly, like, people look at the defensive end position and, like, or I guess pass rusher, right? And they, like, look at my numbers and they're like, wow, this is, like, crazy. Like, you kind of figured it out. It's, like, the easiest position to grade. It's, like, do you have an outside move? Can you be fielded on rundowns? And then do you have a counter off of your outside move? That's really all you needed to be at least make an NFL roster. You know what I mean? And Tyrone Holmes checked off all of those boxes. I think I did a breakdown with Matt Waldman for his RSP film room, and I think I pretty much covered my bases there with that one. Tony Khan follows me on Twitter and stuff, and I bet he follows all you guys too. But I was just like,
yeah, I was actually gonna bring that up, like, for people listening. Tony and Justice talk about this stuff. It's not like Justice isn't some. I mean, he is some kid in his mom's basement, but
I'm in the suburbs. Get out of here. I don't even live in Odell anymore, dog.
But like people in the NFL, they do pay attention to his work. Like this is legit stuff that people do pay attention to. But yeah, sorry for interrupting you. Go ahead.
I mean, if you want to get into like, I've talked to scouts and I still think that they think I'm like BSing them. Like I still like it's gonna have to be more years and years and years of this like working out in public, because you couldn't find a person who was saying that like Dante Fowler wasn't a top 10 pick.
Right.
When he was drafted, like people were saying, the go-to comparisons for Dante Fowler when he was drafted was Justin Houston and Khalil Mack, who were both fourth players, and Dante Fowler wasn't anywhere close to them as far as being, you know, an athlete, because Dante Fowler just wasn't there in the three cone and he wasn't there in the short shuttle, which if you watch his college film isn't really surprising because he had like three sacks in his last regular season until he had like a three sack game against ECU. He wasn't a guy who was really an edge bender. I mean, we've had this conversation before where we were talking about Dante Fowler is kind of like when he was kind of that hybrid interior pass rusher. And it was like, oh, yeah, that's kind of his role. Like, that's where he was best utilized at the college game. But the problem was at his with his frame, even what at what he was back then, he was a freshman or a sophomore.
Yeah, he was playing as a true freshman.
Yeah, I mean, even then, he wasn't a guy who could put on the pounds to play that Michael Bennett hybrid role, whatever you want to call that, at the NFL level. So it was like, oh, okay, well, let's just make him light and we'll have him, like, bend the edge. But that's not, like, it's not an inherent thing to be able to bend the edge. These are the freakiest of freak athletes. Defensive linemen are the best athletes in football, and football's probably, outside of basketball, is probably the most athletic sport on earth, you know, relative to size.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So, like, I think if like there was some sort of like college rules NFL, Dante Fowler, if he were like a hybrid end D tackle, he'd be amazing and he'd still be amazing to this day. But the problem is just he playing at that role at his size, he wasn't gonna be able to make it, and then him slimming down really didn't help him that much.
Yeah, you can like still kind of see him like in the preseason games, like he's still going like straight to the bull rush, like he's still thinking he's 270 or whatever against like these FBS offensive tackles, and he's just getting stonewalled each time with it.
Yeah, and that's really the only move he's ever had. Like you were just talking about, when I first saw him as a true freshman, he was playing mostly on the interior, and I thought that he was going to be the next one in the line after like Sharif Floyd and the one that the Patriots drafted?
Easily.
Yeah. And I thought he was going to be the next in line in terms of like that star interior rusher that Florida had. And then they started messing with his weight and moving him outside, like to he was straight up playing as a linebacker. I mean, his best performance as a pass rusher, in my opinion, still is when you line him up as like a linebacker over a center. Yeah. And he can get, like, a running start versus an interior rusher.
And that's the closest he came to getting a sack in the preseason was when he came, like, on a stunt like that.
Right. And so, and just with him specifically, like you pointed out, Justice, he has the body type that's – it's actually very, very similar to Dwight Freeney. Like, they're both 6'2", 260-ish, 265, and they both have that really, really big lower body. Like they're carrying most of their weight in their lower body. The only difference is that Dwight Freeney at 6'2", 260 ran like a 4.41 and had a 40-inch vertical, I believe. Like
Dwight Freeney's out here. Dwight Freeney's crazy twitched up, and Dwight Freeney also has like the best in, you know, counter spin move to the inside.
Yeah.
Anyone's seen. So it's like Fowler still hasn't developed a When people talk about things like when they're like signature pass rushing moves, they almost talk about it like it's like something like almost like a wrestling move or something like that. Like, yeah, that's what people want to watch on film or something like that. No, it's like if you don't have a way to put the fear in God of, you know, shooting that C gap for a bookend, then there's no way he's going to overset and give you that inside. So if you're losing the game athletically on the edge, you're just going to get shut down every time. So if you haven't really – you need athleticism to be able to run pass rushes through the C-gap consistently or, like, tremendous speed of power. You know what I mean?
Right. And yeah, that's a good way of putting
– That sets up your inside move. Because really, exactly. If you want to rush inside, that'd be the easiest path to the quarterback every time. It's a shorter line, everything like that, right? But you have to shoot outside because of the way that, you know, bookends work and the stances are and their inside –
if an offensive tackle isn't worried about getting beat to the outside versus you at all, he's just going to sit on your inside moves and on your bull rush. If there's no threat of getting beat with either speed, like straight up speed around the edge, speed to power, or agility of a guy being able to like to half man him and dip his lower body around and skim the edge, then there's no reason for him to ever overset, and those inside moves are never going to work. And that's kind of how it gets specific to Dante, because his agility numbers and his jump numbers were both so bad, and you can see it kind of reflected on what I mean, and that doesn't even go into like him tearing his ACL too. Like we don't know if we're going to even still have the Dante Fowler that tested at those numbers. We don't really know if that guy even exists anymore 100%. So I don't know. How you brought up how there's really two, like the three cone and the shuttle to kind of shows agility and bend, and the jump numbers kind of show explosion and speed to power. He doesn't really have either one of those things, and those are the two really the things like where you bread your butter as a pass rusher, like where the physical traits absolute and what you do in those specific drills more so than any other drill for any other position. The three cone drill shows off bend for pass rushers, and the jumps, the broad jump and the vertical, shows lower body explosion, and those two things are absolutely translatable and verifiable on the field, I believe. And so it's going to be interesting to see how Dante's how his career develops. I believe that you said his closest physical comparison is Jabal Sheard. Am I correct?
Yeah, that was the guy who I pinned him as. And then people think like I really like hated Dante Fowler, like I called him like undrafted or something. Like Dante Fowler for me was still like a late first, early second round pick. I think that's the range that I had him in. I just didn't think he was like that. You know what I mean? Like I didn't think he was gonna be Justin Houston or, you know, Khalil Mack. And that was when Khalil Mack only had like four sacks or something like that. But he was coming off of a rookie year with all those pressures and whatever. But I mean, Jabal Sheard makes the most sense of all of them, where it's like, if you get really good with your hands, you're going to be an okay pass rusher who can, like, hold down a starting job. And there's no shame in that. It's just unfortunate that that's the type of guy that got drafted third overall.
Right, exactly. And, like, just to wrap this all up before everybody else can bug you with Packers and Jaguars questions. The guy with the best athletic profile, unfortunately, is the guy that they ended up cutting in Tyrone Holmes. And it's unfortunate that they couldn't keep him, but I mean, I don't agree with the rationale, but I understand where they're coming from kind of, in that there's not really an easy path to playing time for him this year, especially since this particular defensive scheme doesn't really, they'll play two lighter edge rushers at a time, but I mean, I'm just kind of worried because me personally, it's like, what are you going to do when one of those guys goes down and then you only have one Leo left on your roster at that point? So I'm disappointed that he got cut. I think down the line, he could have ended up being the best out of the three guys that they had, but they're going to roll with the guys that they've invested more draft capital in first. So I kind of
things make sense when you put job security, right? Everything comes down to job security and then in the NFL. And it's like, if Tyrone Holmes is ready in 2 years and Gus Bradley gets fired this year, how much does that help you?
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of just the situation that this team is now. They're saying that the roster's built and they're ready to compete and everything. So they need guys that they think are going to be able to contribute right away. The only thing is that I think that, like I said, it's not like Tyrone Holmes was an athletic freak who couldn't play like a guy they tried out a couple years ago in Dakota Watson, who had absolutely fantastic measurables. But you watched the guy, and he was lost out there. And Holmes, he did everything that you could ask for. You know, he produced when he played. Like and flat. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's all you can ask for. If you have any more thoughts on just the edge situation in Jacksonville, force players or anything of that, go ahead and chime in. But I'm going to kind of let the other guys take it on from here to preview this Packer game. We've already gone like 30 minutes, I feel like, with the edge rushers.
I'm good. We don't have to talk about Dante Fowler anymore. Y'all did it for an entire offseason, so.
Yeah, no yeah. kidding.
Well, as long as we don't talk about Chris Smith either, then I'm good. But okay. What's it called? Okay. Basically, what's it called? The Jaguars, like Jaguars Packers preview, whatever. Jaguars, like historically under Bradley, like their starts to the seasons have just been horrendous. I mean, I think before last year where they won their second game, I think their like earliest they won a game was like week 8 or week 9 or something. And then even like last year in their first game, like the team that played against the Panthers was so dramatically different from the team that played the rest of the season. Like that game was just like a defensive like mess between the two teams. Like
yeah, slop fest.
The offense looked horrendous. Like even like Robinson couldn't separate. Bortles looked bad. There was no running room whatsoever. And then the rest of the season is just complete opposite. And so like my basic question for you is like, how do the Packers like historically under McCarthy and Rodgers, like when they're not blowing playoff games, like how do they look like in the week like one, like start the season off?
They're kind of weird because they're usually in a spot where it's like it's either like a week 6 game and they're going against like the Houston Texans on like Sunday Night Football and it's like, oh wow, this is for the season. They need to win this or they're like not going to get into the playoffs in the NFC, or they'll like just beat the crap out of the Seahawks in week 1. So they're kind of like heckling giant. Wow, that was messed up. I messed it up, man. They're kind of like one way or the other. It doesn't really make sense with them. They're kind of inconsistent. Like people would like you to believe that they are on like a week-to-week basis, and especially in the playoffs.
All right, gotcha. Makes sense. Well, I mean, I feel like we have a pretty good idea for how they'll start this one, but gotcha. But what is it? Like basically with the how Jaguars' defense is like set up now with all their like the pass rush. It's I'm confident saying like it won't do anything against the Packers, especially with the Packers scheme, like the traditionally against like quarterbacks like Rodgers. Like I can't think of anybody that's just carved them up one like Rivers, and you know, just like those guys that can extend plays and the quick hitting pass plays. So I don't expect them to get any pressure, but against like their like how do the Packers receivers match up with the Jaguars like new set of like DBs like Ramsey, Prince, House, etc.?
I think I don't know, because I really don't – I still don't know what to think of Ramsey. I mean, I saw some of the preseason snaps, but even then, I mean, it's only like a couple – I mean, it's like a half, right, that like Ramsey's in, and you can't really – I mean, it's so hard to tell anything about DBs up front. I would say it matters more probably for your safety just because of the way that the Packers try to use Randall Cobb as kind of like a vertical stretch guy out of the slot opposite of Jordy Nelson. Whoever's the cornerback opposite of Nelson is probably going to shut down Devontae Adams pretty soundly. Jeff Janis is going to finish the still
catches. Is Nelson like 100%? Is Nelson like 100% like full go?
Bro, that's what they're saying.
Playing a full slate, he's not going to be on a snap count.
Yeah, so I mean, no that's what they're saying. To Cam. I don't know if they were just trying to slow play him the entire preseason because of that other knee injury that kind of popped up. That was kind of like a minor thing. And they just didn't want to risk it in the preseason again. Because, I mean, that's how he went down last year. Was it a non-contact it was a non-contact play against the Steelers in the preseason. So I don't know if they just wanted to shut him down just for the preseason until the regular season started. But it sounds like every single thing coming out of Green Bay is that he's going to play and he's going to play every single snap on offense.
Yeah. Speaking of the Packers offense, pretty much everyone in Jacksonville and their mom wanted the Jags to sign Josh Sitton after he got released, but he ended up going to Chicago. Who's going to be filling in for him at left guard now that he's gone?
Yeah, so you know how like after the draft every once in a while, there'll be like those lists of like here are the guys who are the undrafted free agents who got like the biggest signing bonuses in the NFL, and like that's supposed to mean a thing even though like half of those guys don't make a roster. Lane Taylor was kind of that guy for the Packers a couple years ago coming out of Oklahoma State. He's a guard. He just got a new contract too this past year in March, and it was kind of weird because it was a 2-year $4 million contract, but he's only started 2 games and he's never been like the guy or like the guy in waiting. Because now, I mean, last year, this past draft, they drafted Jason Spriggs in the second round, who was kind of a bookend, and people thought that he might play guard just because basically the Packers, Bakhtiari, who's their starting left tackle, Josh Sitton, who's their left guard, TJ Lang, who's their right guard, J.C. Treader, who for the most part was like their sixth offensive lineman last year and kind of bumped in from – I mean, he played left tackle in a playoff game and is like a center as like a base guy. I mean, before he went down, he had the starting job from that Corey Linsley, who almost made the Pro Bowl as a rookie 2 years ago. So it was kind of a weird spot where they're like, all right, four of our six best offensive linemen are free agents, and everyone thought Jason Spriggs was going to be the next guy to step up in the lineup other than maybe like – J.C. Treader. It was kind of a situation where Spriggs was going to be the swing tackle and Treader was going to be the swing interior lineman. But Linsley went down, so now Treader's starting at center. So I guess kicking out at guard is going to end up being Lane Taylor, which is kind of weird because he's only started two games. So we'll kind of see what he's about.
Yeah, and I guess that really will be the only chance for the Jaguars to develop a pass rush whatsoever in coming out of Malik Jackson, which you can't really bank on for a pass rush being a three-tech defensive tackle who's just going to try and open holes for guys that can't actually pass rush like Dante Fowler. But, I mean, would you say that that'll be the biggest weakness then in the Packers offensive line, or is that
– for sure. Because I think those other guys are, like, starting caliber. You know what I mean? Like, I think if – like, if J.C. Treader hit the open market, I think J.C. Treader finds a spot and gets, like, a R.J. Sweezy deal or something like that. But Lane Taylor, I mean, I really don't know what to think of him. And he's been on the Packers since 2013, and I've watched every single snap. So it's like, I really have no idea how that's going to go. And Malik Jackson took over the Super Bowl. So, I mean, that if there's one way that, like, this could go terribly wrong, that's the way it starts.
Yeah, like, I legit, like, I saw, like, the tweet, like, McCarthy, like, named him the starter. And then, like, I looked him up just on, like, the Twitter search function just to see, like, what Packer fans, like, said of him, whatever. And one of the first tweets was, like, from, like second week of training camp, and it was like somebody was like, I'm 100% positive Lane Taylor's getting cut this season or some shit like that.
So Justice, we've talked quite a bit about the Jaguars defense or lack thereof, but like about the Packers defense, you know, what are some weak links there? Like, I'm not going to pretend like I've seen more than, you know, three plays of the Packers during the preseason, but like, what are some weak links there? If you're the Jaguars offensive coordinator, what are you attacking there?
I think if they can make the game go long, it'll be the defensive line, just because there's not a lot of depth there. Basically, they're starting like heavy end was Josh Boyd, who went down with an ankle injury last year. It was cut after the draft this year, and they really didn't have anyone to step up into that role. And then another guy, Mike Pinnell, is suspended for the first four games of the year. So they kind of screwed themselves that way. And then B.J. Raji retired, and he was their starting nose tackle. So you get to a spot where it's like Mike Daniels and then like a bunch of rookies. So like a guy like Dean Lowry, who was a fourth-round pick this past year and is like 21 years old, is like their starting base end, you know, their heavy end in their sets. And then like LaTroy Guyon, who was a free agent 2 years ago, and like people in Minnesota didn't think he was anything, is their starting nose tackle. And now the guy coming off the bench isn't B.J. Raji, it's Kenny Clark, who's a 20-year-old from UCLA. Mm. And then like the only other defensive lineman on that team is Christian Ringo, who was a sixth-round pick last year and hasn't really seen any reps. So their defensive line, they'll go out in three front, you know, with three interior defensive linemen, but they only have two backups. In that set, they have Dean Lowry, LaTroy Guyon, Mike Daniels, Kenny Clark, and Christian Ringo. And two of those guys have like really never played, or I guess three of those guys have never really played in the NFL before.
Is Jones just like a full like outside linebacker now?
Dayton Jones is going to take Julius Peppers' spot. Dayton Jones looked amazing in the preseason. It wouldn't surprise me if he just completely supplanted Julius Peppers and made Julius Peppers like a one down or two down type of guy. The other spot that I'd look at as far as like a weakness on this Packers team would be inside linebacker. I mean, everyone pinned down Sam Barrington as their starting inside linebacker. They missed him last year. But like he was the guy who called – he was at the draft and did like their second round pick, and he got cut right before 53-man rosters were called out. So everyone thought that Jake Ryan and Blake Martinez, who's a fourth-round rookie out of Stanford, were kind of fighting for a single inside linebacker spot with the Packers. And the truth is that they're now starters. And Carl Bradford who is kind of like their, you know, he was floating on their two deep as an interior, as an inside linebacker, is now on the practice squad. So right now they only have like three active guys as far as inside linebackers are concerned. The other one's Joe Thomas, who's like this undrafted guy from last year, who is basically like, he was only in on Green Bay's, they call it like Psycho or Amoeba, right? Where it's like basically like six pass rushers standing up and just like moving around and just rushing the passer and just like on like fourth and longs. And he was like their coverage backer in that situation. So that's their inside linebacker depth. So, I mean, if you want to look at the Packers and you're trying to beat them up, it's just run it down the middle because they don't have much talent at the top end and they don't have depth at the low end.
Mm.
Yeah, that's what I was just gonna say. It sounds like this would be a game where you would want to come out, especially with it being so hot in Jacksonville early in the season, because that like this team's home field advantage. I mean, it hasn't really been like this in recent years, but going back to the Coughlin and Del Rio areas, they always did really, really well for home openers. And a big reason why that always was, and Coughlin really believed this, was that heat is just so stifling for teams that especially are not like used to practicing in that type of humidity every single day. And, you know, early in the season, conditioning might not be completely up to par. You haven't played, you know, a 60 snap four quarter game yet. And so what it really sounds like to me, it sounds like you guys have like two or three NFL vets in your interior five, period.
Like two. I mean,
like Mike Daniels and nobody, basically. It's Mike Daniels and
Latroy Guyon, who almost went to jail for like having the heater and like pounds of weed and like cash and bundles. Like that's the vet on this team other than Mike Daniels. Like the most experienced inside linebacker that the Packers have is Jake Ryan. He was a fourth round pick last year.
One question, and this just goes to my unfamiliarity with the Packers in general, but why was Mike Neal not brought back when there's all these questions hovering around their pass rush and their
he's garbage.
He is garbage.
Yeah, he's not good.
He's not good. And plus he's being looked at.
He's certified not good. He made a lot of like free agent top 100 lists because he was like in the second rotation of pass rushers in Green Bay. But people don't want to tell you that rotation was bad enough to move Dayton Jones out to outside linebacker and that Clay Matthews wasn't there. Like Clay Matthews might still be playing inside linebacker. I have no idea with Don, because Don Capers really doesn't care what position you're playing. Like he's going to drop you back into coverage and then he'll blitz you the next play. He doesn't care if you're a cornerback and then he doesn't care if you're a nose tackle. That's just how he kind of goes. So like they're saying that like Clay Matthews could play inside linebacker. Morgan Burnett, who's like usually a strong safety, could play some inside linebacker, which makes sense because the Packers really like going in like that big safety nickel or whatever you want to call it, bat packages with like three safeties. They really just like hanging up HaHa Clint Dix at the top and then just like doing whatever down below and just sending heat. So that wouldn't really surprise me. I mean, we really haven't seen this iteration of the Packers defense. You just know that it's coached by Dom Capers, so it's just going to be zone blitzes.
You basically know Dom's ideal defense for Green Bay throughout his tenure it's been like he wants to run 2-3 techs out of a nickel package and then have like five different pass rushing linebackers. Like he doesn't care. He doesn't give a shit about stopping the run. Like he has not cared about that whatsoever in Green Bay.
He wants to get you off the field. He wants to get you off the field with a sack or an interception. And that's really it. He doesn't care about a damn thing after that.
Yep. So do you have a specific prediction for this game, how you think it's going to go?
Man, what's the Vegas line right now?
I think I saw over-under was 47 points, but I'm not sure what the line's at.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head.
Whoever's pounding keyboards with fury, tell
Google
me.
Google it quickly.
Meanwhile, while they Google that, I had a question about the running backs. Last year, we saw Lacy get off to a poor start, and it ended up being that Lacy and Starks were splitting the carries. Do you think it's going to be like that again this year, or is it going to be Lacy carrying the load?
Yeah, I think they'll probably split carries, especially if you're like in a no-huddle situation. I think James Starks is probably the no-huddle guy. I know that's how that kind of worked out in Green Bay last year. People like to say that Eddie isn't fat anymore. Eddie's still kind of fat, bro. Like Eddie's still
Eddie's always going to be a little bit fat, man.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking Starks would be the only one that actually can, like, perform in a no-huddle offense because he can move with the offense.
Yeah, the Packers didn't even have, like, I think their third running back right now is coming from Vikings camp, so, like, he might not even know the plays. So, yeah, that's not good.
It's just basically going to be those two guys.
Yeah, it's those two guys cooking. So it looks like the spread is, like, 3.5 for the Packers. That's a little much, I think. Because if you figure that's a six, that accounts for a 6-point swing.
Right, with home field advantage.
Yeah, so Packers by like 10 at home. That's a lot of points for any NFL team. I think the Packers win, and I feel good about that. I that half point kind of freaks me out.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't. Especially if the Jags come out slow, like they historically kind of have under Gus Bradley, and I don't mean just slow in like the beginning of the season. I mean slow to start out games too.
Yeah.
I think the really the only thing that you're worried about as a Packer fan, especially if you're betting on the game, is like a backdoor cover. Unless Jacksonville can, if they come out and really run the ball and control the time of possession and limit Aaron Rodgers' time on the field, I just don't know if the Jags defense can keep up with that offense. I just don't know if they're going to bother or fluster Rodgers whatsoever. He might not even – I mean, unless he comes out like he did last year kind of and is just kind of like – is confused by what he's seeing and holding the ball a lot. And I just don't see – I don't see them flustering him or really even getting close to him at all. Yeah. You have to hit that, dude. You have to.
Their best bet is really just like whoever is lining up in front of Taylor, be like Malik or Marks or Day. Like they need that guy to be the best like pass rusher on the field, basically. And if he's not consistently getting back to them, like defensively, I think they're screwed. And like they need Allen Robinson to have one of his like better games probably too. Like just like for how I think the pace of the game is gonna go.
Well, the thing about the Packers is they kind of have like a little high variance situation at cornerback, because like Sam Shields is a good cornerback. I think since he entered the league, the only guy who has more interceptions than him is Richard. I can't remember if it's Sherman or Revis. It's one of them. But the thing about Sam Shields is like you can get him on double moves and things like that. Like he really is like he's a whole lot of like recovery speed. You know what I mean? But right. I think Allen Robinson could go vertical with him. I don't think that's an issue. Even though he's a pretty good athlete. And then opposite of Sam Shields, the guys who are going to end up starting are either Demaryius Randle, who hadn't played cornerback since high school up until last year when the Packers drafted him as a safety coming out of Arizona State in the first round and moved him to cornerback. And he hasn't really been a starter. And Quentin Rollins, who was playing basketball basically his entire career until he was like one of those graduate, I'm going to switch from basketball to football type of guys at Miami of Ohio. And he was like their fourth cornerback last year. And he's kind of like the third safety type of guy at times, along with like Mika Hyde and Chris Banjo. So you could feasibly see a way, like if you're going to paint a picture on like how the Jags compete with Green Bay, it's going to be like on the offensive side, like Blake doesn't turn the ball over, right? They run the ball down the middle. And Allen Robinson's able to come down with a couple plays. On defensively, it's just got to be like Malik Jackson just overtakes Lane Taylor. Interior. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Eddie Lacy's not in shape. They don't have the running back depth to really get things going. Jordy Nelson may not be himself. And then like Devontae Adams or whoever's the third receiver by the fourth quarter, if it's Jared Aberderis, just can't get the job done. Like, yeah. There's still questions on, you know, on this team. But I mean, a lot of dominoes have to line up, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that's a lot of things that have to go right, exactly.
Yeah. If the Packers offense really starts clicking with, you know, having Nelson back and maybe seeing Cobb kind of get back to his 2014 form after he had, if I'm correct, he didn't have as great a season as everyone hoped after signing that contract last year. But you really would have to kind of bank on, you know, Tashaun Gibson being everything and more that Bradley wants out of that single high cover three free safety in the corners to come out and play lights out if that Packers offense is starting to click.
Yeah, and that's one thing. It's really weird for these teams who run that kind of Seahawks type of defense, right? Because like you saw in New Orleans last year and like Ryan's talked about it, right? Where he's like, dude, we just didn't have the horses to run with it. I think the Jaguars are now at a spot where, like, they don't really have massive holes on that defense, but, like, they don't have the playmakers either. You know what I mean? And you have to have those type of playmakers. Like, Earl Thomas is making plays. Richard Sherman's making plays. Those pass rushers are making plays. Those guys can come out and they'll front up three guys who should be playing six or nine tech and just line them up. They'll line one up in the A, B, and C gap, and then they'll have Cliff Averill play on the other side. And yeah, I don't think the Jaguars really have that right now.
The way that I've been describing their defense all offseason, and it's why I keep saying please temper your expectations for improvement for this defense, is they have a bunch of guys who you would feel great about, like on all three levels, you would feel great about, like the best player on all three levels, you would feel great about your defense if that was like your second or third best player in that unit.
Right.
Devon House, perfect example. And you can kind of talk about Devon because he's a former Packer. Mm-hmm. I love that dude. And there was Sports Illustrated actually had an article today about an anonymous scout, excuse me, talking about the most underrated and overrated player on each team, and House was the most underrated player for Jacksonville, and I've said that. I think the dude is great. Everybody just kind of has that the DeAndre Hopkins game seared into their memory, where Hopkins killed him down the stretch. But he's been really good, and he's a really good fit for this scheme. It's just that you would unlock more out of him if he was like the second best player in your secondary instead of being the guy. Malik, same way with Malik Jackson up front. Like, I would feel great about Malik if he was like the second or third best player in that front, like how he was in Denver.
Yeah, and, like, we kind of talked about, like, last week, like, the only guy off the top of my head, like, on the whole, like, what we project, like, the starters to be out, those 11, is the only guy I can really think of who, like, has, like, legit maybe, like, star-like power, who can be, like, one of the better players of his position is Ramsey, and he's, like, a rookie, so you can't really, like, expect that, like, especially it's, like, his second season, like, playing corner full-time, so I think, like, in time he can be that guy, but, like, this year, for, like, short-term purposes, like, still...
All right. Do we have anything else that we want to cover about this Jaguars-Packers game on opening day? Anybody else got any other thoughts or questions or anything like that? Justice, you got anything else you want to get off your chest for this matchup?
Nah, I can make the Randall Cobb joke again.
All right. So we'll wrap it up. Just kind of... we'll ask Justice what he thinks his division winners are going to be, and like who we all think are going to win the different divisions. And then we'll give the Hankstead Award and we'll get out of here, 'cause we're going to be running kind of long on this podcast. So I guess we'll start off with the AFC South. In my opinion, I think Houston's clearly the most talented team in this division, and if they can get just like even replacement level quarterback play out of Osweiler, I actually kind of think they run away with this division. I think what we saw with Indy is more of what we're gonna see, and I think that the Titans are better than Jaguars fans want to believe. I think that the Jags ultimately end up coming in like second or third in the division with like 7-9 or 6-10. And Houston.
Yeah, I mean, you watch the Texans week 3 preseason game, and I know we can overrate those a lot, but once you saw that offense start to go against Arizona, and the way that they were spreading guys out, and the way that Osweiler's very comfortable in that type of, like, spread type of offense, and I didn't know that, I mean, I guess the Texans really couldn't field that last year because they didn't have any quality receivers, right? But now it seems like they kind of got four guys that they can roll with, and they kind of looked more dangerous than I thought they were going to be.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and this preseason has really made me feel bad in terms of hating on the Titans, because their running game, the Titans' running game is the absolute truth, and I'm not going to like facing that twice a year.
Yeah, they've invested heavily in that offensive line and in running backs. I mean, well, their defense is so bad that they might not get to use it as much as they want to in terms of volume, but in terms of effectiveness, if they're able to play you close, like you are not going to want to tackle DeMarco Murray and Derrick Henry for 4 quarters. I absolutely agree with that. AFC North, does anybody have any strong? I think that the Bengals are the clear best team in this division. I think Pittsburgh. I mean, I don't think that they're the same team without Martavis Bryant. I just don't think they're the same team and they're the same offense without that dude. That dude, he's like a multiplier for what he does for that offense.
The Steelers have been needing like defensive back help for like 10 years too.
They have been.
They got Justin Gilbert. I mean, let's all be excited about that, and I'll go ahead and hang up.
I talked about this on Sully's podcast too. I actually like the Browns as like a frisky team, not a good team. I want to make that caveat. I don't think that they're going to be good because they easily have the worst defense in the NFL. They're not going to be able to stop anybody. But that offense, I think, is going to be frisky and fun to watch. And I, in my opinion, I think that they're a better team than Baltimore this year. I think that Baltimore is a bottom four team in the NFL.
2-14.
AFC East, it's the Patriots and everybody else, even with that 4-game suspension.
I think the Bills are going to be really bad. Like, I just can't come around to thinking Rex is going to do something with that defense.
There's just so much going wrong on that defense already in, like, what is, like, a weird must-win year for a second-year coach. There's just so many things that can go wrong, and then, like, both of the Ryan's brothers are just talking in public. Wasn't Rex out here in like a Trump hat? Like, we got to get this dude out of the paint. And then they like freed Ty God, but like waited super long until they like signed him long term.
And they didn't really commit to him too. And they're talking up Cardale Jones a lot. Like, that's the guy that they want to roll with long term. You can tell. You know what? I actually kind of like Buffalo more than the Jets this year. I think if you look at like the Jets schedule, what it starts off. Like, they could very well be, like, 2-6 going into week 8. Their schedule is gnarly.
I remember I wrote about that a little bit when I was going through, like, week-by-week projections for Bleacher Report. And I was like, oh, my God, this could go.
They have playoff team after playoff.
There's a couple teams that kind of got hosed at the beginning of the year where it's like, oh, Tampa's like that, too. If you look at Tampa's schedule, I want to say that, like, you look at it and you're like, damn, you guys could go, like, 0-6, like, from the jump.
And they're all like, everybody has already been banging the drum on the Jets too. It's like regression candidate, because they so like their core players are all a little bit older. Fitzpatrick sat around and got fat all summer. Like, he didn't he did not do a damn thing until like August 4th when he strolled in to sign that contract. He did not move this offseason. I think the Jets are going to kind of bottom out. And I disagree with Hank. I don't think the Bills are going to be good in anything, but I think that they're going to be like, they're going to be nipping at the heels of the Patriots enough. Cause I think the Patriots might go 1-3 during, I don't have any faith in Garoppolo at all. I think that he's bad.
He is in fact bad. I'm trying to remember who it was. It might've been Matthew Fairburn, but I'm not positive, but somebody tweeted out, it was like right after the draft. It was Rex. He was like, I'm pretty confident in saying like we won the offseason or something like that. And then they tweeted out like a list of all the players they lost. And it's like legit like 9 or 10 players who are like, we're gonna like be like major contributors.
Yeah, well, their entire defense is hurt or suspended. I mean, their top two draft picks, they were counting on to be immediate contributors, and they're done. Let's move on
Rex Ryan is just trying to get the best people in the best places to just try to make Buffalo great again, man.
Exactly.
Doing his thing.
Does anybody have a single thought about the Dolphins whatsoever?
Because I don't care about the Dolphins.
No, but I don't think anybody gives a shit about the Dolphins.
They're the Miami Hurricanes of the NFL. Nobody cares.
I care less about the Dolphins than Ndamukong Suh, man.
AFC West, the Broncos, returning Super Bowl champions, are rolling with Trevor Siemian. We're recording this on Wednesday night, so we're gonna get to see, or I mean Tuesday night actually, so we're gonna get to see the Broncos kick the season off with Trevor Siemian in a couple of days. They won so many close, sloppy football games last year, and I know that that's like their brand of football and what they're built to do, but I just don't think that they can replicate that with Trevor Siemian. I think that they're a pretty easy regression candidate to call out, especially too because they're just dealing with it with the attrition of their players getting big contracts and signing elsewhere and things of that nature. I mean,
getting shot in the leg, things of that nature.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we basically keep signing, like, the Jaguars every offseason are guaranteed to sign a cast off from the Broncos and give them like $100 million. It's been like clockwork. The Chiefs, I think, are actually like a sneaky, like, they're a sneaky like AFC contender play, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think so.
Alex played really well down the stretch of the season. That's something that not a, like the casual football fan. The ones who have actually really picked up on that are all the fantasy guys that notice. Like once Justin Houston went down and that defense kind of wasn't like the dominating and like they didn't have Justin Houston. They didn't have their two best players basically in Justin Houston and Jamaal Charles. So they kind of put it on Alex and Macklin, and that those two guys carried them, and they responded and played really well. So. I think that they're one of the most complete teams in the NFL. I think it's going to be them, the Patriots, and the Bengals are your top three teams in the AFC this year.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. Like, I think that offense is going to be like sneaky, like really good. Like, even with Charles banged up, like Spencer Ware like might legit be a really good running back. And then they still got Kelce, Macklin, and then it seems like they have like. Two or three receivers behind Macklin who, like, none of them are, like, you know, like, scary, but they're all, like, solid.
Do we have thoughts on the Chargers at all?
I hope they go, like, one.
Garbage.
Yeah.
Philippe Rivera.
Yeah, well, the Jaguars absolutely cannot beat Philip Rivers or the Chargers in San Diego. They will get – I mean, it's the I will be at that game. I don't know if any of you guys are. I will be going to the Chargers-Jaguars game in San Diego to get them see them get their teeth kicked in. The Raiders are everybody's, like, darling – the Raiders and the Jaguars are, like, mirror images of each other, really. They're, like, everybody's darling offseason team that everybody expects to take a step forward, and I'm still of the opinion that both of these teams are still a year or two away.
Yeah, like that defense, like in the preseason, it legit still looks like bad.
Oh, it's Khalil Mack, a rookie safety, and a bunch of nobodies.
That is not even starting.
Well, they're kind of like they're transitioning to like a 3-4-2, but they're like. It's all new guys. Like, can you name an interior defensive lineman in Oakland?
Well, I think like, Mario Jihad. Edwards just went on IR, so they're going to be counting on Jihad Ward to start.
Yep.
And Jihad Ward is not good, in my opinion. I did not like that dude coming out.
He can't hit. Like, you have to play him at 5, and you have to play him at 5 because he's not athletic to play 6 or 9. And at 3, he's going to see double teams and get moved 15 yards off the ball.
Yeah, so. It would be exactly like you saw in the, I think it was the Ohio State. It was the Ohio State game, I think.
Yep.
This is getting crushed like 10 yards downfield. This is too much Raider talk. I don't care about the Raiders. I think that's the entire – did we miss any divisions in the AFC?
No, that was AFC.
No.
All right. NFC, we'll start with the North since that is your division, Justice. I actually predicted the Vikings to win the division last year as soon as the Jordy injury happened. I said Vikings are going to win the North, and it came to fruition. After the Bridgewater injury, and I'm of the – like, I really like Teddy coming out, and I've kind of – I'm not soured on him in the NFL, but I understand his limitations, and he's kind of a capped upside guy. But I can't see Sam Bradford surviving 16 games behind that offensive line. I don't think that they're going to be a very good football team this year. Well, as good as the defense is.
Like, I wrote about Sam Bradford earlier this week, and my whole thing was, like, basically everyone who capes up and is, like, Sam Bradford still deserves a shot in the NFL is, like, yeah, he's never really had the offensive line or receivers to get it done. And I'm like, dude, they're going to rush him through a Vikings playbook that he's, you know, he just got playing behind that line throwing to those receivers. Like, their number two receiver is a guy who started last year and had, like, 15 catches.
Yeah. The Vikings
Laquan
fans
feels like their fourth receiver right now. Like Laquan, I mean, Treadwell had
it's weird too because Vikings Twitter is weirdly like so down on Adrian Peterson. And I mean, I don't really understand why they're so like they'll tell like a lot of them will tell you they feel like Stephon Diggs is the best offensive player on that roster. And if that's not a good offense,
it's
if
not
Stephon
good.
Diggs is, yeah, if Stephon Diggs is your best offense, if you.
A second year, day three receiver. That's who you run your offense through.
Yeah, I don't know. I love Zimmer. I love that defense, but I just I have no faith. I've seen Sam Bradford play enough in the NFL to where I've never watched Sam. I'll put it like this: Sam Bradford is one of those guys. I've seen a ton of games of him, and I've never watched him and thought like, "Oh my God, the defense should be worried that he's about to like take over this game."
I just want to see Sam Bradford throw the ball to Moritz Boehringer when they pull him up from the practice squad.
The Bears are the Bears. They're caught in that weird spot between rebuilding and trying to win with a veteran quarterback who's kind of like Jay's not on his last legs, but like it's within the last probably. It's on the downslope. I mean,
I just don't think they'll be good until Cutler's gone.
Exactly. Yeah. Well,
the thing about the Bears that's super weird is like they entered last year, and I think by like week three, they had the best odds because they played like the Packers and like the Cardinals back to back to start the year, right? They had the best odds to finish the year with the first overall pick, and then they ended up being like respectable for the rest of the year. The Bears offense is kind of weird, man, because they're about to lose Forte, but they seem super confident in Jeremy Langford, who kind of came in. I want to say he played that primetime game against San Diego. I remember seeing that like at a bar or something and just being like, damn, Jeremy Langford can actually like play football at this level, you know, like
he's actually pretty good.
Like the whole thing is like basically the way that the Bears defense or offense is kind of ran is they don't even let Jay Cutler go, like they don't let him run plays where he can do something stupid, like on first like double slants. It's like throw a double slant. All right, like there's no deep route. Like we're just not gonna let you do it until third down. Which is why I think last year was Cutler's best year that I've seen. You know what I mean? Like we were on. I mean, entering last season, the talk was like Bears probably need to be looking at quarterback next year. You know what I mean? Yeah, and now they're kind of like settled in a weird spot. Defensively, I want to say like 10 of their 11 listed starters are brand new guys. Like brand new.
Brand new. And that defense was a disaster. Everybody knew it was going to be a disaster, and it was legit bad.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think right now with Sam Bradford playing for the Vikings, I think if anyone's going to be a threat, it's going to be Chicago. But if you look at Matthew Stafford's stats with the Lions in the second half of the year last year,
just going to ask you that.
Yeah, because there's a huge split. Because the thing about the Lions, it seemed like the Lions and the Eagles, I know a lot of people talk about like X and O's and things like that, and it's kind of hard to filter through that, you know what I mean? But it seems like the Lions and the Eagles, there was legitimate, like, we know exactly what they're running based on what formation they're in. Because as soon as Jim Cooter took over and they were like, we're stripping down the playbook and there's like three formations and we're going to run every play through every formation. We're not going to have a specific formation for a specific play.
Which is stupid.
Remember, it was like week two or three and the Eagles receivers were crapping out their face talking about how the Cowboys sideline was calling out the plays at them, like as they were lining up, and they're like, "Oh shit, it's inside zone."
Yep. Predictability. Moving on to the NFC South, which is in my opinion, I mean, it's between the NFC South, the AFC South, and the NFC East for like the worst division in football. The Panthers carried this division last year all by themselves, but not to disparage the Panthers, but I think they're somewhere in between like where that 15-1 team that showed up last year and the 7-8-1 team that won the division the year before, where they were pretty much like a 500 football team but won a weak division. They're somewhere in between that, I think. I think that they're gonna be much closer to the team that you saw like the first 8 weeks or so of the season, where they were kind of like they were almost winning like Denver, like sloppy, not like drag them out, knock them out football games, and then that offense kind of it went another level down the stretch of the season. So I think that you kind of see a team that more closely resembles that the team that showed up for the first 8 weeks or so, and then everybody else in the division I think is terrible. I mean, Tampa Bay, they're one of those teams that I think might get like you brought it up, the opener to their schedule is absolutely brutal. But once like once they're eliminated, basically, and expectations have been removed and they just kind of start rolling with young guys and featuring young guys again, I think that they're going to be that team that kind of gets hot down the stretch, and they're going to be the sexy team that everybody picks next offseason. That's still probably a year away.
They're the team that you want to buy stock in for, like, 2017. That's exactly who they are. And then, like, the Saints, dude, like, the Saints, I still don't – they wanted to upgrade on the defensive line, so they moved Holy Kikaha from outside linebacker to D-end, and he blew out his ACL for, like, the fifth time. And then they drafted Shelton Rankins in the first round, and he's hurt too. So it's like that Saints defense still isn't getting any better anytime soon. And the Falcons, I mean, it's former Seattle defensive coordinator football, right?
Yeah, the Falcons are not – the thing that amazes me about the Falcons is that, like, it seems like finally everybody else is finally caught on to the fact that Matt Ryan at his peak with two all-pro receivers and the best tight end of all time was going to be a guy that got you, like, 250 yards and, you know, a touchdown and a half, two touchdowns a game. And that was, like, his peak. That's going to be his, he's going to do that every single week. He's not going to really fluctuate or deviate from that. And as the supporting cast is kind of crumbled around him on offense, all they really have is Julio and Devontae. And I think that they overworked Freeman last year. Down the stretch of the season, he was not the same player.
It sounds like they're trying to get Coleman more in. Like, it sounds like Coleman's going to be, like, their outside type of guy. But still, I mean, that's whatever.
Yeah. Coleman's not good. So, and the thing is, like, Matt Ryan's not 27, 28 anymore. It looked like he hit a wall in the middle of the season. He's like 32 years old.
Would you rather have Matt Ryan or Alex Smith?
I would rather have
Alex Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Definitely.
Does anybody disagree with that?
No.
Because the thing is with Alex is, you know that Alex not going to make a boneheaded play. Me personally, I see Matt Ryan being on the exact same trajectory as his backup right now, Matt Schaub, where they were good, efficient, volume guys for a long time that threw to, like, a dominant wide receiver, but when the arm strength went a little bit and they kind of hit that cliff, it was interception and pick six city. I see that exact kind of progression in Matt Ryan's future. I don't, like, he's 32 years old. How much better? Like, he's not going to get any better. He is who he is at this point. Mohamed Sanu is not going to be the difference maker between, like, he's not going to revitalize Matt Ryan's career.
Mm-mm.
So I don't know.
I think Matt Ryan is the Baker Mayfield of NFL.
Yeah.
I
apologize to everybody who is listening to this that we talked about the Raiders and the Falcons this much. What division do we have left? We have the NFC.
We have the NFC West.
This is probably the most interesting division race in football. You have two legit powerhouses. Yeah, you have two legit powerhouses, and then a legit frisky team. Like, they're a 500 team that beats that plays well against good teams in the Rams. Where do you guys see this division going? Because I can see, like, a million different ways.
I still kind of lean Seahawks, honestly.
Seahawks?
Yeah.
Ryan?
Seahawks probably run away with this division. I think the Cardinals just, I mean, with what they lost on the defense this offseason, I just think, like, the Seahawks, you know, just go with it by at least a game or two.
Yeah, the Cardinals starting winner was playing receiver last year or something for A&M or something like that.
Yeah, like, Arizona could – if you ask me which one of these teams completely falls off a cliff, it's definitely Arizona, and the reason is Carson Palmer. Like, Carson Palmer did not look good this preseason, and Carson Palmer hasn't looked good since he had that injury last year. And he's an old dude, so I don't know, man. Like, that one kind of worries me a bit, where we talk about Matt Ryan and it going downhill fast. I mean, Carson Palmer is a guy who kind of lived and died off of arm strength, and if you're throwing – you know, if you're a vertical stretch team – and your quarterback's not there, that's going to go real, real bad.
Mm-hmm. Zach, anything?
I'm probably still thinking the same way, and I was going to try and make an Omar Kelly joke about Seattle, but I can't really think of anything. it's going to be Seattle that runs away with it if Carson Palmer doesn't return to at least the form he was at before he got hurt.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of surprised that we're all in agreement on this, because I think that Seattle is the best team in this division too, and they end up getting the one seed in the NFC. Just because that, it seems like the Cardinals are everybody's kind of darling team, so to speak. I mean, they have so many fantasy assets, so the fantasy people love them. The media loves them because of Bruce Arians, and fans kind of love them for that same reason. Like, Bruce is a really engaging, funny coach. Like, he's kind of like a, just kind of a breath of fresh air from what most NFL coaches are. So they've kind of become like everybody's darling, but I kind of agree with you guys. I think that if you run Seattle's season last year, if you ran it like through a simulator, I forgot who it was that said this. It might have been Sigmund Bloom, but like last year's for Seattle, that was like the worst possible expectation that you could possibly have for them, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that they underachieved a little bit last year, and a lot of that was like not really knowing what they were going to get out of Marshawn week to week, and they didn't really start riding Rawls, and when they did ride Rawls, like, he broke his leg. The running game came back to life. Russell Wilson just dominated down the stretch of the season. So
had no idea how to use Jimmy Graham. They traded away their center for him.
Yeah, they're better without Jimmy Graham, in my opinion. They're a better team. They don't know how to get him in. He just doesn't fit that offensive ecosystem whatsoever.
They don't want to run him seems to win, and you got to run him seems to win if you want him to be effective. Go vertical, and then if that guy stays up too high, find an open spot in the middle of the field.
Yeah, exactly. Like, well, and the concept that they ran against when they started in that playoff game against the Packers, where they just started going like when they let Russ start going shotgun heavy, and it was inside zone, zone read, inside zone, and they got into overtime, and they got that exact look they wanted, where the Packers were running a zero blitz, everybody's matched up man to man. Like, the only that should be their base offense at this point. Like, they should be running that offense. Through that, it should be like they can still go under center and do a lot of that stuff, but that should really just be like the under center stuff should just be like a first down package for them. That offense needs to start being run through the gun. And then, I mean, I don't know if Jimmy Graham's ever going to be healthy again, but him is kind of a vertical slot, like not even as a tight end. Like, you're basically just using him like Marcus Colston, or he's just running up the seam from the slot, and you could get him involved doing that, but I don't know. They still kind of have a. I'm interested to see what their identity is on offense that this year. I think that's going to be kind of fascinating with this being like 100% Russ's offense now. Any other thoughts on the NFC West in general? Do we care about the other two teams at all?
I mean, no. I just want to see Goff, like, at least see the field instead of being inactive when he was the first pick in the draft. But, I mean, with Jeff Fisher there, they're still going 6-10 or 7-9 or 8-8 for that matter.
Yeah. Okay, so this is actually a perfect segue to going into the East. The NFC East is our last division here. If you're the Rams and you trade up to that number one overall spot, and if you redrafted the draft right now, do you think that they pick Dak Prescott or Jared Goff? I think that's a legitimate question right now.
I have no idea.
I don't know. I think if they sit back instead of trading up, maybe.
Well,
I mean, that's
that. There's no way that Dak's going to be there. Dak would go in the top two in this draft.
Give me Brandon Allen.
Because the thing.
Stop it.
If you got to redo the draft right now after seeing the preseason, I don't think that Cleveland would ever trade out of that spot. Even if the Rams were set on Goff, I think Cleveland would take Dak.
Yeah, they would. I mean, Dak and Hugh Jackson is just meant to be. So, yeah.
Oh, so I wasn't really a huge fan of Dallas going into this year, and. Just because, like, I didn't expect Romo to play 16 games and he didn't even make it through the preseason. I don't know. I think they're like, Tony is probably the most underappreciated quarterback of his generation. He's not Hall of Fame, but he's like Hall of Very Good. He's one of the most efficient passers in NFL history, I believe, while also being, in my opinion, one of the best improvisers. just a very, very underrated and underappreciated player. But I think that there's, like, there's something to be said about, like, extending your window and riding with a young guy. And I obviously this team, I mean, the offense is much better and the defense is much worse, but I can kind of see some parallels here with what Seattle went through when they just decided to roll with Wilson through his rookie year.
I'm there, man. I'm taking Dallas. I like Dallas more than anything.
You like Dallas to win the division?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think the only other team big step who's back. Competing, like New York, still doesn't really have a defense, even though they spent all that money on it.
I have no faith in the Giants at all under McAdoo for whatever reason.
I'm good. Well, you know, former Packers offensive coordinator Ben McAdoo. But like even like the other team that I think could compete. I mean, Philly's not winning nothing.
I think that Washington is like a sneaky top five team in the NFC. Like the entire NFC.
Yeah, but what does that even mean, though?
Yeah, that's true. That you're wild card team.
Like all these other teams. Like I think like other than like if they're behind. So if they're behind the Packers, the Seahawks, and the Cardinals, right? And the Panthers.
You know what though? If Kirk Cousins is better than Carson Palmer this year, which I don't think is out of the question, they might be a top three team.
It just depends on how the rest of the core of the offense works out. Because I mean, DeSean Jackson is what DeSean Jackson is now, and Pierre Garçon. They have to see how Doxson looks, because I think he just finally got back out to practicing. And then
Matt Jones sucks. So it really just depends.
Yeah.
Their running back situation's bad. I think their offensive line's kind of overrated. I think we saw them take down who was it? It was the Rams in week one, and we were like, oh, wow. Look, Callahan completely fixed that offensive line when that's not really the case.
It's not.
When Trent Williams, if they're good and competitive early, he's like he's the best left tackle in football. I think he's right there with the Dallas dude. Yeah. But he's Sully talked about this on his podcast. He's prone to getting disengaged very quickly if the team is not good, and so Brandon Scherff, I can't say that I watched a ton of.
What is he playing now?
I still think he's at guard, right?
Yeah.
Moses is playing tackle for him.
Yeah. So, they got a couple of pieces that could potentially be elite. It's just like, I think they've got the worst group.
Who's their star defender? Can you name a front seven player on the Washington Redskins?
Preston Smith is probably the only one. Kerrigan's like
Preston Smith and Ryan Kerrigan.
Yeah. I don't know. This division overall,
this is the worst. Like the winner out of this division is the worst division winner.
Yeah, this is like one that it would not surprise me if this is very similar to like how the AFC South was last year, where it's like three teams that are like hovering right around, you know, 6-8 to close the season out are going to be battling to be the slapdick in the playoffs that loses at home in the first round. Any thoughts in general, anybody, to like what you guys think, NFC title and AFC title, like I guess we kind of talked about it, who we think the best teams in the division are. And the NFC, I think it's pretty clearly Arizona and Seattle. And in the AFC, I think it's I really, really like the Bengals. I know that they're worse on paper than they are this year, or they were better on paper last year than they are this year. But, it's not always the best team on paper that ends up having the most success. Like the example that I mean, Denver last year, that is not the best version of the Denver roster. They had a better roster the year before and even the year before that. The Baltimore Ravens, when they won the Super Bowl, that was like the weakest version of their roster in recent years. And you can tell like it's just been all downhill for them since then, because that was just kind of the last gasping breath that they got out of that roster. It happens a lot. Like the best version, the Patriots, like, are quite often like the best teams they have on paper are not the ones that end up winning Super Bowls for them. So I kind of like the Bengals for that reason. Like, even though they're not as good on paper, I like the continuity and everything. I think Dalton kind of hit another level last year. So I like them, and I like the Chiefs this year.
Yeah, but I mean, if you see the Patriots playing in Cincinnati or in Kansas City, like with Tom Brady at quarterback, who do you think is going to win that game in the playoffs?
I think that the Bengals could have won. Like, I think the Bengals could have done legitimate damage last year had Dalton not gone down. The Chiefs, yeah, especially like their eight minute drive to close out their game against the Patriots was just so brutal to. It was literally like a flashback of Andy Reid's Eagles.
I was gonna say, I was like, a Chiefs Chiefs Super Bowl run has to involve Andy Reid at least in one, like coming out of one clutch.
The clock in the fourth quarter, yeah. So.
So I don't know about that one. I think I were to go like the three teams that I think that can compete in the AFC are probably like the Bengals, the Patriots, and the Steelers. Those are the guys I'd feel most comfortable with. And then the NFC would probably be Seattle, Carolina, and then the Packers. I feel more confident in the Packers than I do the Cardinals. Just because of the Carson Palmer thing.
Oh, yeah.
The Carson Palmer thing just means, like, we'll know what the Cardinals are like 2 weeks into the year. You know what I mean? Like, you ask me 2 weeks from now, we'll know what the Cardinals are. But until then, I'm still like, I can't get footing on that one.
All right. Anybody have any thoughts to wrap us up for like all the division previews and everything?
No, I'm good.
No, I think we hit it.
Yeah, this is gonna be a nice lengthy podcast. Hankstead Awards. Are we gonna go through that? My only pick would be cut the staff for cutting Tyrone Holmes. I was not. I know it's a rookie sixth rounder from Montana, but like I said, there's just so many reasons to keep him. The benefits of keeping him so far outweigh of the potential losses of losing that guy. And the Browns basically get a guy that they got a free force player that they didn't even have to draft. Basically, they didn't even have to spend a draft pick on the guy. I mean, you guys spent a sixth round pick on him. You only have two other edge rushers, true edge rushers on the roster. One of those guys is, I mean, if you're expecting like 16 games and 70 snaps a game out of I don't think that they had the depth to be cutting Tyrone Holmes, and that's my Hankstead Award winner.
Mine goes to the coaching staff. For all preseason and offseason, we've kind of questioned how they're handling Miles Jack and where they're putting him, and then Bradley came out after practice on Monday and said that he's getting a lot of time at Will and is providing depth there as well as playing special teams, and you don't draft Miles Jack to be a special teamer, so I mean, they're going to do what they're going to do, and we're all just going to be pissed off about it. But
yeah, the whole linebacker situation is just
shit.
Weird. Yeah,
we didn't talk about it. I mean, I've talked about the linebackers enough this preseason, but they're just they're doing weird shit, and I don't like it.
I mean, I think right now Hank's going to get the same amount of playing time with the first team as Miles Jack is. By the way, Gus is saying it.
Well, that's fair, I guess. But I mean, mine would be like. I don't know. Like, cutting Ryan Davis is mine. Like, I know a lot of people, like, he had, like, no plays on the team and whatever. But just saying out loud that the Jaguars cut willingly parted ways with a guy who had almost seven sacks 2 years ago. And it's so fitting that, like, they're apparently, like, the team that has the most interest in him right now is the Colts. So by the time they play in London, he's going to sack Bortles 3 to 4 times. He's going to be the new Greg Marshall.
Yeah, my Hankstead is also a roster management front office move. We kept, for some reason, five running backs on our first 53-man roster, and then we decided not to IR Josh Wells until like 5 hours into Saturday so that we could then, you know, put Wells on injured reserve and then bring Aurelius Ben back for our sixth wide receiver. And Dave Caldwell said the whole time six wide receivers would be a weird move in terms of special teams play and stuff like that. It just seemed like totally disorganized. It didn't seem like they knew really what they were doing. And so my Hankstead right awards for Saturday.
How he did this whole roster was weird this year. They got like four tight ends, four running backs.
I was going to say, let's actually talk about that for a minute. Go ahead, Hank. The way that the numbers ended up coming out makes no sense to me at all.
Yeah, and it's all like, and plus like three, like everybody knew they were going to carry three quarterbacks, but just like the numbers, like traditionally how they've done it, three quarterbacks, they have four, at one time they had five running backs, so four running backs now, four tight ends, six receivers, and then you look at defense and they got, what, like three defensive ends, like actual defensive ends, and then
two, because they're counting Chris Smith, but Chris Smith is like an inside outside guy. He's not a true weak side edge rusher.
Got it.
But he's a force player.
He's the Justice hedging mid tier. I always forget about him hedging with the mid tier. But yeah, go ahead.
And then like I what was it? I think it was Ryan O made the point that like they don't even like their backup safety, like they just figured out like who like they even want as like some like the death pieces in the secondary. So just how they like made that whole like jumbled mess like of like the offensive skill positions. Like it just feels like Caldwell, I don't think what he really like on defense, it was obvious like the guys like he was okay with parting ways with. Like he's like, okay, I didn't make a big investment in this guy, you know, it's cool like to part ways. And then like Holmes and like Jordan Tripp, like two guys people thought were gonna make the team. And then but in offense he kind of did the opposite. It was like these low like cost guys that like he's kind of made like his personal projects that he kept on, like Joe Sterling and then Corey Grant.
Yeah, they just every offensive like you, I guess you could call them pet project, like you said, who they kind of even think might have like an inkling of a little teeny tiny role in the future, they just went ahead and kept all of them.
Yeah, and it's weird because the offensive side of the ball is the side of the ball where like those type of guys are going to play the least, like on this team.
Yeah, like I said, there's no, you couldn't really like see a path to playing time for Holmes until like maybe next year, but like none of these guys that they kept on the back end of the roster for as far as wide receiver, tight end, and running back are like none of these guys are even really going to be active.
Yeah, like Grant,
they're not even going to be on the active roster on game day.
Yeah, like Grant, like returning kicks is like only one off the top of my head where I can think like is even going to do anything.
I was just kind of disappointed like when they first released that roster and they had the five running backs, but then they carried the five linebackers. Like, how do you do that when you have Paws and Scuda and then Jack, who's a rookie, and I'm not a skeptic of his knee whatsoever, but coming off of like the end of his college career. So really the only and then you've got Telvin and Hayes Pollard. Like, how do you keep five linebackers and five running backs when you need more depth at linebacker?
They added Arthur Brown too. So they're riding with six linebackers. They have a starter, they have three starters, and they have like three true backups, which is kind of strange for a 4-3 team to carry six backers like that.
And it was kind of weird, like, what was it? I think it was Gus said when, like, they signed Brown, like, he's going to play, like, strong side linebacker, and he's not at all, like, the type of guy they've played at. But I'm done trying to figure out what they're going to do with the
linebacker. Yeah, well, if you've watched them so far through the preseason, it's pretty clear that the auto is, it's dead. It's not a real thing anymore.
I've got up some of the transcripts from right now, and we say the auto's dead and we all want to believe that and we pray that one day the team will just say, you know, screw the auto. But I'm reading the transcripts from Bradley's press conference on Monday, and someone asked who will back up Dan Scuda at the auto position. He was surefire on Arthur Brown being an auto.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that they're calling it auto. That's just the name of the position. But the role for it is not what they were trying to sell it as a couple of years ago, where it's almost like a 3-4 strong side linebacker. Like that, the guy's gonna be play. It's gonna be like a traditional 4-3 Sam linebacker. Like he's gonna be like covering tight ends and, you know, setting the edge, and not really ever like used as a blitzer occasionally on like one man pops, but he's not gonna be like a true edge presence. The thing is, they've never had the guy on the roster to dedicate a position to that anyways. They have not found that guy yet. I mean, they tried to do it with Scuda last year, but, I mean, he's just – you don't create a position for Dan Scuda.
The like very first guy they even, like, tried at the position was, like, Watson, who, like, we talked earlier. And I feel like the guy, like, for the way they described that position, I feel like the guy that – was best suited for it that they've had was actually Davis, who they put there this offseason, and then he just didn't get any snaps whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Right. And well, it was strange too is that they tried to sign Olivier Vernon and as a true weak side edge Leo, and then Robert Ayers
as
the inside-outside guy. They've kicked the tires on Hardy as the inside-outside guy. But the guy that they never showed any interest in at all, who actually is a guy that, like, the auto position was basically, you know, created for this guy in Seattle, was Bruce Irvin. Like, you actually have the template of this guy doing that, and they showed no interest in him at all. So it's just kind of weird. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, fuck
I think does anybody have any other thoughts or anything to add to this very long podcast?
Go Jaguars.
Nah, I mean, I'm good. I'm ready to be the 1 and the 15 and 1 for the Packers.
That's right. The 1 and the 15 and 1, baby. Shout-outs to Tony. So, Justice, thank you. We really appreciate you coming on. And like I said, you can follow Justice on Twitter at Jumosk, J-U-M-O-S-Q. Like I said, he covers the Packers for Bleacher Report. He works on the NFL 1000 for Bleacher Report, which is basically scouting every NFL player that, you know, is on a roster, basically. Am I correct? Like, every single one?
You plug me for two different things. You call me a Packers columnist, which I haven't been for 2 years, and that I work on NFL 1000, which I'm not signed to work on. So
okay, cool. I'm glad that I'm up to date on what you are working on currently.
I write about game.
Go ahead. Yeah, plug yourself, since I have no idea what's going on with you anymore.
So, Justice Mosqueda, you can follow me on Twitter at J-U-M-O-S-Q. I write for Bleacher Report. We're doing – I mean, Playmaker Mentality is dead. RIP to that. Yeah. I think Eric and I are going to have a little project soon, if we can get this thing off the ground.
We're trying to get it off the ground. It's coming.
But, yeah, so I'm doing gambling pieces that will run on Friday for Bleacher Report, and then two other articles throughout the week on whatever I want to write about, basically. Awesome. So follow me on – you can find my – yeah, you can write – you can follow my writer profiles in my Twitter bio, so you can go to that.
Here to save us from the sorbet.
You already know.
So on that note, we will we're gonna end this. Thank you, Justice, for coming on. We're gonna have another friend of the podcast, Kyle Posey, come on to preview the Chargers next week. He's a Charger fan. He's working at Bleacher with you now, I believe. Am I right about that? And Kyle Posey.
Yeah, and Kyle Posey.
We're expecting to have him on. And so thank you for checking this. Like I said, this is a very long show. Thank you for checking it out. We crammed a lot of stuff in for this week. Everybody's super excited for week one and for kickoff weekend for the NFL. It's like a bunch of drug addicts getting, like, some methadone, basically. It's like the light, like, that's what college football was this weekend for everybody. I feel like that was like some methadone when you were really coming off of something. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. Subscribe, please, and review the show on iTunes if you're enjoying it. Like I said, it really, really helps with the outreach and everything. Tweet at the Big Cat Country handle using the hashtag Keep Chopping Wood for suggestions, comments, anything else like that. And we will talk to you guys next week.